two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready?
What's going on here?
Resistance is futile.
This, indeed you are, Paul,
is...
It's in my hand, Paul!
Fan Effect.
How many of you have ever read a book and thought, oh, I wish I could see this made into a movie? Well, I'd say fewer and fewer are saying that because more and more things are being made into movies. In fact, a lot of books, before they're even written, have movie deals signed. Hi, I'm Andy Farnsworth. Welcome to another episode of Fan Effect. And it's not limited to just books either any longer. Video games have become a popular thing to translate into movies as well. We've covered this a little bit, partially in podcasts past when we've talked about specific movies. But today, we're going to talk about three specific movies because this is fresh on the mind. The top movies for the last few weeks have all been based on either. Two of them are books, and one of them is a video game. That would be Call of the Wild. It would be Sonic the Hedgehog, and then The Invisible Man. All of them based on something, a work that someone else had put together and then adapted into a movie. Joining me now for this episode is our geek tyrant writer and frequent co-host, Christian Odlin from California. Christian, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you back. Now, Christian, I haven't seen all three of the movies. I've seen two of the three. You've seen all three. So what we wanted to do is we want to talk a little bit about the movies in case you haven't seen them, kind of give our thoughts on them. And then we're going to talk about a little bit about the process of adaptation, the difficulties of adaptation, the temptation to adapt, and, you know, really kind of dig deep into this as we get going here. So, Christian, why don't we start with the one that maybe was the biggest surprise of them all, and that would be Sonic the Hedgehog.
I shouldn't even be on this planet right now, but I am, because you shot me.
I know.
You shot me!
All right, I heard you the first time. You don't have to pile it on. Good grief.
Now, Sonic the Hedgehog, originally, it made the news well before the movie came out, in that Sonic, in the original trailer, well, he just didn't look right, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
Fan outrage was high, and we ended up getting the movie's release date pushed back from November into February, November of 19 into February of 2020.
And a lot of good memes on the internet.
Lots of good memes. In fact, I actually think it's kind of interesting to go back and rewatch that original trailer, having seen the movie and the updates now, because everything feels exactly the same, except for the one
isn't
thing.
Isn't it funny that they left it up? You assume they would take that down after that they left it up.
I actually guessed that they left it up because it had the best Jim Carrey stuff, and I'll get to Jim Carrey in just a minute.
Yeah.
So, Sonic the Hedgehog, for those of you who maybe haven't seen the movie yet, the film revolves around a blue hedgehog named Sonic who, for some reason, can run at supersonic speeds. And Sonic is voiced by the hilarious Ben Schwartz. If you've seen Parks and Rec, he played John Ralphio. He's been in a bunch of other shorts on the internet. He's a very funny actor. Anyway, Sonic lives on another planet, but then gets sent to Earth to hide from those who would try to exploit his power for their own gain. And then he hides out near a small town in Montana, and to avoid going crazy from boredom, he secretly watches residents live their lives, in particular the town's sheriff named Tom Wachowski, played by James Marsden, who was Cyclops in the original X-Men. He's been in a ton of stuff. He's in Westworld, you know, guy, you've recognized the guy.
Hop.
Yes, he was also in Hop. Thank you for reminding. So when Sonic accidentally causes a power outage that affects the entire Pacific Northwest, the government hires a genius drone and robotics expert named, appropriately, Dr. Robotnik. How lucky that that was his name, right? Anyway,
yeah.
Robotnik's played by Jim Carrey.
Whatever this creature is, our job is to secure it, neutralize it, see what makes it tick.
And he's hired to investigate. So now Sonic needs the help of Sheriff Wachowski to evade capture and get back his teleportation rings, which is a whole other thing that I'm not even going to bother with,
right.
And keep Robotnik from using Sonic's power for world domination. To me, Christian, the story is a huge stretch of the imagination, and to be quite honest, it's better if you don't think too hard about it.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, the fact that it's based on a video game series that really didn't have more than a minimal story to begin with actually kind of helps, I think. At least it did for me, because it helped lower expectations for what I was going to see. And
right.
Then, of course, it's really aimed at kids, and I think that's who probably end up liking it best. But, you know, most parents played Sonic, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you grew up playing Sonic, you would. There's plenty of nods and winks to those adults, too, for sure.
Yeah, those were the Easter eggs that I enjoyed. The Sonic music that you heard at one point, him running through the grassy loop-the-loop.
Even the rings, you know?
And the rings themselves, like, that's probably as good a way as you could come up with to explain the rings. I mean, why else would he be collecting them? So I liked that. What were some of the things you liked about it?
Well, again, going in, I didn't have very high expectations. So I've seen it a couple times now. I saw it once by myself, and then I saw it once with my kids. Going in the first time, I kind of had really low expectations, you know, because the video game movie genre, it kind of has a low bar, to put it kindly.
That's fair. That is very fair.
And, you know, I was mildly impressed. And with Jim Carrey aside, because obviously for me, Jim Carrey was really the main reason this movie was so enjoyable. If you took him out of the picture, I still think it wouldn't have been that bad. His personality really adds a lot to it, and I think for those of us like you and I who kind of lived through the prime of Carrey in the 90s, this was like, it was so great to see him back at it.
When Carrey is at his funniest and on top of his game, he's like goofy, he's elastic, he's almost like a human cartoon.
Yeah, and it brought this movie to another level. I think that's what really pushed this movie into the higher echelon. So
I have missed this Jim Carrey. I really have.
Me too.
And I didn't realize how much I missed it until I saw this movie and was like, I miss this guy.
I know.
But if early career Jim Carrey is not your cup of tea, then you might not enjoy the movie the same way that Christian and I did.
That's true.
My two boys loved it, and they each gave it 5 out of 5 stars, they told me right after. Dad, are we going to buy this as soon as it comes out on video? I said, we'll see, maybe. But I liked Jim Carrey so much, I ended up giving the movie myself. I gave it 2.5 out of 4 stars. It was probably 2, but I enjoyed it. I kind of liked that nobody took it too seriously. Like, Marsden looked like he was having fun. I like his wife in the show. She's Tika Sumpter, and she plays on the show Mixed-ish. It's one of the Black-ish spinoffs. She plays the main character's mom, and I really like her, and she was great in this, and everybody was likable. One thing I will say, in a way, I kind of wished the whole movie was animated, because I think it might have worked. There was just that little disconnect of, I kind of at least get why they wanted to animate him in that realistic way at first, because it does fit with the world that they create around it. When he's literally the only animated character, having him look like a video game seems a little even more out of place. So if they were going to go with the video game look of Sonic, there's a part of me that would have kind of liked to see the whole movie animated.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But
then at the same point, we would at best get Jim Carrey's voice. And not his antics and I think that was probably, I don't know, maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe this was planned to be an animated at one point, and they were like, well, if Jim Carrey's on board, it's live action. I don't know.
Like I said, he is a human cartoon, so maybe it would have lost something if Jim Carrey hadn't been able to do what he does, like to where you're watching it just in awe of his physical gifts as a comedian. So, all right, so Sonic the Hedgehog, likable, based on a video game, so, I mean, what was the plot of the Sonic video game? I don't think I ever beat any of the games. I got multiple levels in of each one, but I don't think I ever finished one. The plot was Dr. Robotnik turning animals into robots, right? That's why when you bopped on them, they turned back into little bunnies?
Yeah, and for some reason you had to get the rings. I mean, the rings basically were your life meter. If you didn't have rings and you got hit, you died. If you had rings, you just dropped them.
And you got the sound effect.
That's basically the plot of the game.
Boom.
Yeah. I did like the little nod in the movie to him getting hit with the rings spilling everywhere, like when he fell off the building and all the rings kind of
jangled,
fell all over the ground. That reminded me of when in the game you get hit and all the rings shoot out.
It would have looked cooler if they'd have done that thing where they go out from the middle of him and he does that thing where his arms wave back. That would be pretty funny. This was kind of a Dr. Robotnik origin story. I think Eggman is his name. My youngest kid surprisingly had watched the Sonic cartoon that's on Netflix.
It's the old 90s one they have on there.
They had a 90s cartoon. Okay, so I missed that altogether when it came out. But they watched it. And in fact, the day before I went to the movie, my youngest son had said, he had been home from school sick. And he said he'd watched all these Sonic cartoons. And I was like, wait, really? Do you want to see a movie about it tomorrow? There's a movie? So either he totally played me, or that was an amazing coincidence.
Yeah.
But it was cool that they were already on board with that, which meant that there was some connection to him. I mean, he's only six, so the fact that he discovered Sonic on his own without having played really the Genesis. And then after we saw the movie, I, of course, got out the old Genesis that I have and let them try out the actual game. And let me tell you what.
Oh, yeah.
I can't get past this part. Do it for me. No! The whole point is you have to do it.
Yeah. I had fortunately let my kids play Sonic years ago, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, just because we have it on a little mini system. And, you know, they liked it. They thought it was really simple. But I was glad that I had let them play it back then because they understood the movie completely instead of just thinking it's a movie and then the video game second.
So we have a video game adaptation that then zooms to the head of the box office in its debut weekend. Actually, surprisingly, it went surprisingly strong for a couple of weeks. So a lot of people were in the mood to check it out. Then we get Call of the Wild.
How do you feel about an adventure beyond all maps?
We should go, you and I.
Ever been before. See what's out there.
Now, in this case, it's Harrison Ford and a canine companion instead of a hedgehog companion. So we had Cyclops
and the very first 20th Century Studios movie.
Yeah, how cool is that? And did you know this? The very first 20th Century Fox movie was the 1935 Call of the Wild with Clark Gable.
That's incredible. I did not know that.
That's a pretty cool little fact.
That's really cool.
So you probably read Call of the Wild back in junior high school. I did.
Yep. I think it was the first book I actually read cover to cover.
But while you may have read Call of the Wild back in school, I would bet that, or even if you do remember, I'd bet a lot of our listeners don't remember much about the book.
Right.
So, again, working in your favor for this movie, book written by Jack London in the early 1900s. It's been made into a movie multiple times over the years. The version I mentioned with Clark Gable in 1935 and then one with Charlton Heston in 1972 are probably the most well-known versions, along with this one now with Harrison Ford. It revolves around a large dog named Buck who gets kidnapped and taken from his spoiled life as a pet of a wealthy owner in the mid-1800s. And he's sold to be a sled dog in Alaska and Canada through several different owners or masters, one of which is John Thornton in this movie played by Harrison Ford. Buck sheds his domesticated traits as he feels the deep stirrings of his animal ancestors and embraces the quote-unquote call of the wild. What were your thoughts on this?
No, I really liked it. I realized the dog was mostly CGI and motion capture, and I can understand why they did that, but there were moments where it looked really cartoony. It was a little distracting, but overall, I thought it was fine. I thought it suited the story well.
That's such a ringing endorsement.
I know. Well, I mean, fine. It's hard because the whole movie is, like, the dog is the main character.
Yeah.
And, you know, they needed to do specific things and have specific emotions. And that, I could only imagine the hours it would take to get that perfect emotional shot from a real dog.
Which should make you appreciate the fact that there were those two earlier versions.
No, that's true. That's very, very true. And then also in this day and age of, you know, animal cruelty, whatever, PETA stuff, he gets walled pretty good with a club. And, you know, they're
right.
gonna, film that with a real dog now.
And of course, they notice they didn't even show it, even with a CG dog.
Yeah. But
it doesn't matter that people are getting shot up to death in the movie. But doggone it, if you so much as strike a CG dog, that is it.
I know. But, you know, I enjoyed the movie. I thought Harrison Ford was great. I definitely don't think it would have been as good if he wasn't in it.
I think that's true. I think that's true. But did he even have to act?
I came up here because I didn't want to be around anyone. And then I met Buck.
That's part of the reason I think it was
really
good, is he could be gruff Harrison Ford and growl his lines. And
and they're like, you don't even have to shave. He's like, oh, yeah.
He's like, but I got to do more pictures like this. I get to go out into the wilderness, and I don't even have to shave. I don't even have to like I like anybody except a dog.
If you want a good laugh, though, I highly recommend you look up some behind-the-scenes footage of him talking to a guy this guy's wearing a motion capture suit, acting like a dog.
So that really did happen.
Ridiculous. Yeah, it's the most ridiculous looking thing you've ever seen. And I know in some scenes they didn't have a motion capture actor at all, but there were a few where they did, and those ones are just hilarious if you see what they look like.
Wow. Well, I personally was pleasantly surprised at how family-friendly the movie was. I don't know what I was expecting, but I liked that it was all ages appropriate. You know, I have to think that maybe that 20th Century Studios that we mentioned, since that's under the Disney label, that may have had some influence on it.
Probably, yeah.
I really loved the vistas of the frozen north. It honestly kind of made me want to go camping, even in the snow, which looks fun in the movie, but really isn't.
Yeah.
But they made it look so enjoyable that I was like, I think I should go snow camping. And then when I was out of the movie, I was like, what in the world was I thinking? I've done that before. It's not fun.
Yeah. No, it's funny because there were moments that felt very, like, straight out of an animated movie. Like, here's a perfect example. When when he's part of the sled dog team and they're coming into town for the first time and they're, you know, kind of wildly out of control, they go off camera and you hear a big bang boom, and then it cuts to them and they're all buried up to their heads in snow.
Right.
You know, that's a very, like, straight out of an animated movie. And I kept thinking the whole time, I'm like, this movie would have probably worked better as an animated movie because of a lot of the things they did. And then I come to find out it was the director, you know, the director who's done nothing but animation up until this point.
Right. He did How to Train Your Dragon. Chris Sanders, Lilo and Stitch.
The Croods. And so then that's why it feels like an animated movie. That's how this guy knows. That's his ballpark. That's his forte.
That's his wheelhouse.
Yeah. So, you know, and for what it was, I thought it was fine, but I think it would have worked equally as well as a animated movie.
I think you're right, but I think it would have lost something if you didn't have real-life Harrison Ford. And I know for sure, since I really enjoyed those vistas.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the idea, like the scene where, a little bit of a spoiler here, the scene where one of the mail carriers falls under the ice. I don't think that would have been as dramatic with an animated version. So I think since you bring that up, he did a good job walking the line. I was looking at it more as he knows how to do a family-friendly movie, but since you point out that those are all animated, that's an interesting point, that there were moments that felt like they were real-life animation crossover. So that's a good point, but that also works towards the family-friendly thing. And the story choices made by the writer Michael Green and Sanders, the director, it almost seemed like they knew you didn't remember the story, so they had freedom to kind of adapt the plot without, you know, the outcry they would get if, for example, they were supposed to remake Harry Potter and they decided to, like, you know, change Hermione to a boy or something. You know what I'm saying? Where if they took any license with a story that younger readers and people today have a deep emotional attachment to, for example, changing the look of Sonic, then there was a huge outrage. But they kind of had, I think, they kind of had some freedom by going with it's an old book and you probably don't remember reading it. You remember it existed. You remember there's a dog and you might remember his name is Buck. But if we can play around with it after that, I thought the adaptations to the story to make it a little more palatable or understandable to a modern audience, I actually thought they were pretty good choices. For example, John Thornton, I'm going to spoil the book Call of the Wild. In the book, he's murdered by Native Americans. And then Buck murders the Native Americans and then embraces his wild side and goes off with the wolves. In the 1972 movie with Charlton Heston, the same thing happens. And it happens towards the end while Buck's out with the wolves, you know, kind of exploring his wild side. That's when the Native Americans attacked Thornton and his settlers. So making it in this movie be an earlier character that you had met. And I'm going to be honest, I'm not going to like go into too much detail just in case somebody hasn't seen the movie and still wants to. But you'll see, you'll know fairly quickly which character is going to end up coming back.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, I thought that was a better way to do it. Just with the way things are with race relations among all races and the effort to not, you know, paint old negative stereotypes. I mean, this was a book written 100 years ago. So I thought that was an appropriate choice. Maybe some people would have quibbles. I didn't. I liked it. And in fact, it was funny. Before I went and saw the movie, I joked with somebody. So here's what I hope happens. I hope that they go all in for changing the story and that Buck and Harrison Ford have to fend off some like smugglers or something in a big heroic battle in the woods. And then they both come out of it scarred, but all, you know, all alive and whole. And I wasn't that far off.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie. I was a little disappointed for the missed opportunity of him calling the dog Laugh It Up Furball. Like, I wish he would have said that in the movie once. That would have been, I would have given it a standing ovation if he did that.
We had joked that at some point when he was out in the wilderness by himself, when he was talking about his son that was lost, if he'd have looked and seen like a picture of a young Adam Driver on in the black and white photo.
Oh, man. That's so funny.
Or saying something like, just a sec, Buck. I got to go do something. And when he comes back, he's dressed as Han Solo from the Rise of Skywalker, and he changes back into his furs. So we had some fun laughing about that, but overall pretty good. Very different from the book is a warning, but not necessarily a bad thing. But you know, really the biggest thing, and you mentioned it, it's just Buck. It allowed for some cool camera movements and allowed you to get shots you couldn't get with a real live animal, like where you could see, you know, the camera right in front of Buck leading the sled team. And then the camera in one shot can swoop around and look up at the avalanche coming down.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But it just, there was too many times, like you said, where it just sort of took you out. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying to tell myself, I'm hoping at some point they actually did use a dog for some of the shots. And then they just took the dog and made a CG model of him for the stuff that the dog couldn't do. But he was CG the entire time. And that was just enough that I couldn't give it more than, I called it surprisingly enjoyable. And I ended up giving that one 2.5 out of 4 stars. What did you give it on your 1 minute critic scale?
I think I gave that a 4 out of 6. Yep.
Okay. So at this point, we're seeing two adaptations that are both slightly better than average, but that still left some things to be desired. Now we come to The Invisible Man, based on a book written by H.G. Wells, who wrote The Time Machine. Then he writes The Invisible Man, which is an interesting, because it's a horror science fiction at its time. And tell us a little bit about this Invisible Man.
Well, let's not forget also, I think it's equally as important to the book. It's equally impactful for the Universal Invisible Man movie. That's kind of one of their staple monster movies. So I think they were really going after kind of reinventing their iconic Invisible Man monster that they brought to the big screen.
And as far as we know, there was no Tom Cruise sightings in this movie, correct?
No, there was no Dark Universe logo at the beginning.
Okay,
no,
just checking.
Of the Dark Universe.
This isn't like a backdoor way back into it, right?
You know, and I, for some reason, I've always been drawn to these movies about invisible men. Like, to name a few that I really like, I liked Hollow Man with Kevin Bacon. I thought that was kind of a nice thriller.
Elizabeth Shue, wasn't she in that one too?
But my favorite Invisible Man movie in recent years, I mean, I think it's from the early 90s or late 80s, is Memoirs of an Invisible Man with Chevy Chase. I think that's a John Carpenter movie.
Is it a comedy or a horror?
It's a comedy thriller. So it's like, it's kind of like a he's accidentally turned invisible, and the scientists who did it are trying to catch him so they can figure out how they did it, and he's running. It's like a guy on the run, but he's invisible kind of movie. If you haven't seen it, you have got to check it out. It's so good.
Really? I didn't even know about it. I thought you were going to say Fantastic Four with Jessica Alba, maybe.
Oh. But I think it has Daryl Hannah and Chevy Chase.
That sounds like it's out of the 80s, right? In an 80s movie.
I may be wrong. It might not be Daryl Hannah. I think it is, though. Anyway, that's a good one. So going into this one, I was really excited to kind of see what they did. The trailers made it look pretty mediocre and average. I don't know if you disagree with me, but I thought, okay, fine.
Well, it's Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men and from Handmaid's Tale. And from the trailers, it looks like she believes her husband is dead. But she also, or at least she thought her husband was dead, but now she's wondering because it seems like things are happening to make her wonder if he's still alive.
Right.
He came up with the perfect way to torture you, even in death. Only thing more brilliant than inventing something that makes you invisible is not inventing it, but making you think he did.
He's not dead, Tom.
Yes.
Okay.
And basically the movie turns, I'm not going to spoil much, but it turns into this almost... Someone had written a review about gaslighting, how someone, you do something to someone to make them believe that they're going crazy or that something really is happening. And she essentially thinks that even though her ex is quote unquote dead, he's still there doing things to her and messing with her, making her go crazy. And it is really tense. I mean, one of the things this movie does so well is the director, who is the creator of Saw, the Saw franchise. He wrote the Saw franchise. His name is skipping my mind right now, but he directed this. He used a lot of old school techniques where you let your imagination kind of freak you out.
He said that wherever I went, he would find me, walk right up to me, and I wouldn't be able to see him.
Right before that part of the clip, she'd mentioned that he was like a really controlling person in life.
Yes.
And she's trying to convince, I guess it's his friend or something like that, that he's not as gone as some think?
Yeah. She basically, the beginning of the movie, she runs out on him, sneaks out on him. And she's in hiding, and then she finds out that he killed himself. And then that's when all these weird things start happening to her.
Okay.
But the director does these incredible things where she's, like, sitting in a room, and you hear, like, a very... This is, like, Quiet Place level quiet. So
everyone in the theater is silent.
Yeah, completely silent. She's sitting in the room alone, like reading a book or something, and you just hear this little, like, kind of a dull tick sound. And, you know, she looks up, and just the way the camera movements envelop the room or, like, focus on just one spot in the room. And there's no CGI there to imply someone's there, but just the way that they do that is so well done. That was my favorite thing about this movie.
Is it didn't have a whole lot of trickery? It was just done.
No, there were no gimmicks. It was like there were gimmicks, but not like Hollow Man and a lot of these newer ones. It was just you in your head. You're like, oh my gosh, they're right there. You know what I mean?
And did they do it well enough? I'm assuming that the husband is actually alive and invisible. But
yes.
do they do it well to where you as a viewer are not 100% sure either? Because that, to me, is where it would be good, is if they can convince you that you're not sure he's there either.
To a degree, yes, that is the case. Unfortunately, the trailer does spoil that a little bit, so if you really want to...
Is that the paint part of the trailer?
Yeah, try to avoid the trailers, but if you've already seen them, it's still definitely worth the while. And the way they lead up to the revelation is very subtle. It's like it just kind of eases into it, and then boom, you're like, oh my gosh.
Now, that's interesting because that's quite a bit different than the actual Invisible Man story originally. Again, this is one that you may have read for school. It depends on where you went to school. But you certainly didn't read it in this particular version. There wasn't a written version of this particular version. So in this one, in the original version, just for some context... a guy shows up at an inn and he's covered in bandages, or at least the part that his face is covered in bandages. He's wearing like a coat and gloves and everything like that. And he starts living at this inn, and you come to find out through the course of the story that he had accidentally turned himself invisible and he was trying to figure out a cure for it, but that it wasn't working very well. And eventually he needs money, so he goes to try to maybe steal some money since he's invisible, and things go poorly, and he ends up having to murder somebody because somebody followed him when he was carrying a pipe for protection, but, you know, the guy just follows the floating pipe and then ends up getting murdered to keep the secret. And then he takes a homeless guy into his confidence, and through the course of the story, he ends up committing some more murders, and eventually in the book, he's murdered by the townspeople, who finally converge on him and beat him to death. And then it turns out the homeless guy who betrayed him and told the authorities there was an invisible man in the town, he ends up with the guy's work and is trying to recreate it himself. That's how the book ends. So with that context, you could have made an adaptation like that, or you could have tried to adapt it straight up that way and just have it set in modern times, like a guy's living at a long stay motel. Right. I mean, there are ways you could have done it to be more quote unquote truthful to the source material. But knowing that backstory now, how do you feel this did as an updating of The Invisible Man for our time? Do you think it was better?
Great. I mean, in some ways, yes. Especially if you were very familiar with the old one, I feel like they do things so differently in this that it's a little refreshing. In the old one, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it like chemically he's changed invisible chemically and he's like permanently invisible,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, and there's some scientific, there were some issues with it,
right,
but I mean
right.
It's science fiction. So but yeah, what happens is he gets covered with something that allows his body to reflect all the light or whatever it is.
Okay. And then this one, the controlling terrible X, he's like a Silicon Valley tech major creator. Like, he's an innovator.
Oh, okay.
And he's developed a suit, basically.
Ah, okay,
that
okay.
That he's told nobody about, but she knows about it.
Okay.
Because, you know, she's lived with him.
Well, but I'm guessing most people are going to this for some of the jump scares, too.
Right, and that's part of the gaslighting, is she's telling people about this invisible suit, and you know they're like, you're bonkers, lady.
Right,
you know, that's part of the whole thing.
And like, that's one I think that you could still enjoy on the second level, because I mean, it's called The Invisible Man, so you got to figure right. That there's going to be an actual person there. And so
yeah.
I from what you've described to me, it feels like you could accept the story and try to watch it as Elizabeth Moss character and feel the frustrations that she has, because you know just like she does, but you have no more ability to convince the people in the movie than she does in the movie, and you're not even in it.
Right. Like, there's a great line in that movie where she's talking to police, and this is after some terrible things happened that made her look not so good. And she's telling him the story about this invisible person, and they're just calling her crazy. And she, like, leans in, and she's like, I can prove it. And they're like, well, okay, well, tell us. And then she leans in, and she's like, I can't because he's in the room. And, you know, and that just furthers them being like, you're totally nuts, lady. You don't know if he's in the room or not, but it, because of what has happened before that, he could be. You know, it's one of those things where you just don't know.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the most enjoyable horror, and maybe even the most unsettling horror, is the psychological one.
Absolutely.
The one where you're not sure if it's in your mind or not. And when you think of something like The Invisible Man, because you can never be sure that he's there, the terror never stops.
Yeah.
Which is a great
absolutely.
Way if you're going to terror. I mean, a great way. But let me put great in quotation marks, which is a great way if your intent is to mess with somebody. That's how about an effective way? Maybe that's a better word to
take,
because I don't agree with
effective.
It. I don't condone it. So of the three movies, Christian, which would you say is the most enjoyable of the three?
I would definitely say The Invisible Man. I would even go as far as saying it's probably one of my favorites I've seen this year.
Wow. Wow.
It's really, the last 10 minutes weren't my favorite, but as an overall movie, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very well done.
Okay. All right. So that's our setup. Those are the three most recent adaptations. For further context, for maybe people who don't watch the Academy Awards a lot or who only kind of dryly scan them, these would be things where best adapted screenplay versus best original screenplay. An original screenplay would be something that creates characters brand new, where they're right. written specifically for the movie. They did not exist in another written form or another intellectual property form somewhere else. Whereas an adapted screenplay, even if it's not a specific, for example, Sonic the Hedgehog would be an adapted screenplay, even though there wasn't a Sonic story necessarily
right.
that it was based on. For example, Joker. Joker was, did it win for best adapted screenplay, or was that... Wasn't it Jojo Rabbit that won for Best Adapted Screenplay?
It didn't win, yeah.
Okay.
Jojo did.
But anyway, so the stuff that we're talking about is stuff that could only be, if it was going to be an Academy Award, an adapted screenplay. So let's do this. Let's have a quick break. And when we get back, let's talk about why do we adapt so many things that we already know? How come there aren't more original screenplays? What are the challenges of an adapted screenplay into a movie? And what are some of the best? What are some of the worst? We'll talk about all those things right after this.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Effect, Andy Farnsworth, and Christian Odlin from Geek Tyrant. We're talking about movie adaptations. Adaptations of somebody else's work into a movie. And there's lots and lots of them. So, for comparison's sake, we kind of did this before the break, but Indiana Jones is a great example of an original screenplay. Character was made up by George Lucas in collaboration with Steven Spielberg. They came up with his backstory. They came up with his story for the movie. And to be honest, it's kind of one of the challenges is why we're waiting still for Indiana Jones 6 is because there's nothing to base it on. They got to come up with the story and then decide if it works with the character that they've created.
Mm-hmm.
Han Solo is an original character. However, Tony Stark is not.
Right.
So these things existed a long time before Marvel movies became the box office giants that they are. So let's talk about this. Christian, you and I are both people who've seen lots and lots of movies, lots and lots of TV shows. Why do we keep going back to stuff that we already know? Why do we want to watch a story that theoretically we already have read?
That's a good question.
Because we do. They make tons of money. So why?
Yeah. Well, obviously star power has a factor in it based on who's cast to play the character. Like we were talking about for so long, Call of the Wild. I really think the success or failure of that movie would have solely been dependent on Harrison Ford's character. So I think that's one of the biggest. And then another would be looking at, like, The Invisible Man, technology in film. I know back in the day when they did the Universal ones, it was breakthrough technology to make him invisible, but you watch it now and it looks kind of cheesy. I mean, it still works. It looks cheesy, but now what they can do, it's incredible.
And that's fair.
That's another, I think, draw for an adaptation. But then you have super fans. Like, look at us. Sonic could be an example. Even though there's never been another movie, I have a feeling...
I have a feeling there will be. If, they certainly teased that there was going to be one.
If they keep making those movies, or even if they remake it, all the gung-ho Sonic fans will go see it. And maybe they are going to see it to see if the studios can get it right, you know?
If you look at the box office receipts from the past decade, if you were to go with the top box office earners for each year of the last decade, it's really interesting.
You're basically getting at most of the successful box office movies are movies that have already existed or they're sequels, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the ones that make the most money are ones that we already are familiar with. And to me, that's what makes it so interesting. In fact, here's the top box office films by decade. Let me jump into the 2010s. Number one, Star Wars Episode 7, Force Awakens. Number two, Avengers Endgame. Number three, Black Panther. Avengers Infinity War. Jurassic World. Marvel's The Avengers. Star Wars The Last Jedi. Incredibles 2. The Lion King. Now, the original Lion King was, it was an original, but it was loosely based on Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Beauty and the Beast, Finding Dory, Frozen 2, Avengers Age of Ultron, Dark Knight Rises, Toy Story 4, Captain Marvel, Hunger Games, Catching Fire, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, Toy Story 3, Wonder Woman, Iron Man 3, Captain America, Civil War, and The Hunger Games. That's the 24 of the top 25.
That's crazy. The top 10, only one of them is not Disney.
That is crazy. That's a lot of money.
That's pretty crazy. That's a lot of money right there.
So that's our top films of the 2010s, top films of the 2000s. Again, this is a decade. Avatar, that is an original, isn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty unique, yeah.
The Dark Knight, Shrek 2, Pirates of the Caribbean, Spider-Man, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, Episode 3 Star Wars, Lord of the Rings Return of the King, Spider-Man 2, The Passion of the Christ, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, Spider-Man 3, Finding Nemo, Shrek the Third, Transformers, Iron Man, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Indiana Jones, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Lord of the Rings, and Episode 2, Attack of the Clones. Now, here's an interesting question that I don't know the answer to. Would Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull be an original or an adapted screenplay? Are sequels considered adapted screenplays?
Maybe it all depends on the source material. I don't know technically, but I would guess it's not adapted just because it's based on an original character that wasn't adapted. But I could be wrong. I don't know. I don't know if sequels...
The top grossing film of 2000, which didn't make the top 20 list, but the only one that was the top film of its decade but didn't make the top 20 overall, 2000, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the live-action one.
Okay.
Here's the 90s. Titanic, original. Star Wars Phantom Menace, Jurassic Park, based on a book. The Lion King, original. Forrest Gump, wasn't that based on a book?
I don't know.
I think
maybe
it was.
Yeah.
Independence Day, I believe that one was original. The Sixth Sense, that was original. Home Alone, that was original. Men in Black, based on a comic. Toy Story 2, based on Toy Story. Twister, don't know if that one's based on a book or not. Lost World Jurassic Park, based on a book. Mrs. Doubtfire, that one I don't know. Beauty and the Beast, based on a children's tale. Ghost, that one was original. Aladdin, based on a children's tale. Saving Private Ryan, that might be based on a book, don't know. Austin Powers 2, so, I mean, it's based on Austin Powers 1.
Yeah.
Terminator 2, Judgment Day, sequel, although the original Terminator was an original screenplay. Armageddon, Toy Story, Dances with Wolves, Batman Forever, The Fugitive, and Liar Liar. So at least in the 90s, it seems like a closer to even split. In the 2000s, not at all. 2010s, even further off. We are getting further and further away from original ideas, and we're either adapting or remaking stories and tales that we've already known.
Yeah.
Why? Why are we moving further away from new ideas? Why are we embracing so hard the old ideas? Is it that we don't have a choice? Or is it that we do have a choice, but we've decided to just choose these?
I think really the easiest answer is that for studios, it's easier to sell something to the public if they already know what it is.
So less of a risk by the financial backers.
It's less of a risk, and if they're basing it off of something that was already proven to be successful in their mind, it's like, if it's not broken, don't fix it. So from a business standpoint, I think that's really why we're getting a lot of the stuff that, oh, that was great, let's make another one. Oh, that was great, let's make another one.
And but there's a natural tendency from us, especially if it's an original the first time, is to say, wow, I liked that. Give me some more. I'd love to have some more.
But it's interesting because there's been plenty of original movies that are so good, but just underperformed at the box office. Some of them even have like a cliffhanger ending where you want kind of sets up a sequel and then nothing comes of it. So it's just one of those. It's like a gambling thing. Like it's all run by the studios. The public really. The only say they have in it is actually going and spending the dollars at the box office.
Well, knowing all of this information that we've just talked about, that at least gives some logical explanation as to why the studios spend so much to buy the book rights.
Yeah.
Because that saves them the trouble of having to come up with everything. There's, in theory, a built-in fan base, or this wouldn't be a bestseller in the first place.
Exactly.
But I think when they buy the movie rights before the book's even published, which happens a lot more than you might think,
right,
then that means that the studios are deciding what, because then they're going to make sure they put the money behind the push to get the book to sell so that they can build the audience right. to go see the movie.
In that case, isn't usually the author a well-known author that has a pretty sizable fan base? Typically, yeah.
Yeah, but I read about sort of more niche authors that a well-off Hollywood actor or actress reads the work, and then they're the ones who option the rights. You know, for example, Margot Robbie, I think I've read Reese Witherspoon has done this, where they're like, I just love this book by this author, and so I optioned the rights so that at some point it can get made, and I want to be the one to make it. I think Big Little Lies, the TV show, isn't that based on a book?
Yeah, it is.
So I'm not criticizing it. I mean, back in the day, you used to have the TV miniseries. In fact, some people would argue that miniseries on TV, and you might even be able to make the argument today that because of peak television and the serialized storytelling that we have through streaming and everything else, maybe the best way to adapt a book anymore is on a miniseries once again.
Yeah.
Because the challenges have been
summarizing a book basically into 2 hours.
Yeah. There's a different animal in that. I mean, think about the Harry Potter series. And I've talked about this on multiple episodes of this podcast. The first time I saw Harry Potter, I had not read the book. I saw the movie and I thought that was fun. It was imaginative. I loved the John Williams score. Chris Columbus, who'd done Home Alone, directed it, and he kind of knew how to turn the inner child, you know, to make that sort of the focus. Mm-hmm. And I liked it. And as I walked out of the theater, I heard other fans who are seeing it for the first time were like, oh, I can't believe they left out blah, blah, blah. And, oh, where was this thing? Blah, blah, blah. And I remember thinking to myself, dude, did you just not see this same awesome movie that I did?
Yeah.
And then I heard more complaints from the various friends. And I thought, well, I don't want to leave this movie feeling like I got gypped. So I didn't read any of the books till after I saw the movie. Until we got to the end of the series, and then I believe the final Harry Potter book, I knew I wasn't going to be able to manage to go another 3 or 4 years without getting spoiled with how the series ended. So I did finally read the last two books of the series before I saw the movies, and guess what happened? I turned into one of those people.
You were like, I got gypped, yeah.
I felt like Harry and Ginny's first kiss was better in the book. So it's so interesting. Jurassic Park, to me, is the prime example of whichever you see first, you seem to lean towards.
Yeah.
I loved the movie Jurassic Park. And then I read the book, and old man Hammond, who was so sweet and played by Richard Attenborough, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, spared no expense. And he just seems like a grandpa who's tried to make a nice thing for his grandkids, and it spiraled horribly out of control. And in the book, he's a jerk, and he gets exactly what he deserves.
You're right.
And I was like, he never even once said spared no expense. And I thought, I liked Richard Attenborough's version a lot better. And so it's a double-edged sword. When I watched Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, I was like, this movie's boring. It takes forever, and there's only really a little bit of action at the end. Mm-hmm. But nothing really happens until the very end when Dumbledore and Voldemort duel. Like, this should be, and to the movie's credit, they did make that out to be more in the movie than they did in the book.
Okay.
So then I read the book, and I was like, oh, the book's just as boring as the movie. And then in the book, I kept reading, like, okay, well, we got to get to the duel pages. Like, it's going to have to be filled out. And it's just like a page and a half. It was super fast, and I was really disappointed by the book. But then when I rewatched the movie the second time, I was amazed at how well they adapted 800 pages down into 2 hours.
Yeah.
So I was actually more impressed by the choices that they had to make. And I got why they left out parts that they did. Even though I enjoyed them in the book, I totally understood watching the movie that second time why they left them out.
Yeah, for me, in my opinion, I think some of the best adapted films ever made are the Lord of the Rings movies. I read all those books religiously before the movies came out, like a couple of times. I've even read them in Norwegian.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I knew those things inside and out. And when I watched the movie, yeah, I definitely had moments where I was like, oh, they left that awesome part out. But man, they really nailed every major bullet point for the most part through all three of those movies. And I was, as a fan of the books, I was completely satisfied with those films. I loved them so much. I still do.
And see, I'm in the process of reading the books for the first time. I'm reading them to my 6-year-old. And it's, this brings me to a point that I wanted to make anyway, but this seems like as good a time as any to make it. If you're going to adapt something for a movie, a book, for example, what is your opinion? Is it better to know who the actor is going to be that plays the characters, or is it better to imagine them yourself?
It's interesting. That's very interesting because I've had the experience both ways where, for example, I'm a big Dan Brown fan. I love a lot of Dan Brown's books.
Okay. Did
but
you picture...
I read The Da Vinci Code for the first time at just before The Da Vinci Code was coming out. Like, so the trailer had been released while I was reading The Da Vinci Code. So basically my entire experience reading every Dan Brown book after that, I always pictured Tom Hanks. Always.
Do you think that was a good thing?
I think it was. For me, I loved it, and I thought it was great. And then in the reverse effect with Lord of the Rings, a lot of the characters didn't completely match how they're described. But, you know, I learned to live with it. And then it's funny because now when I go back and read them, I picture the movie characters.
Right.
So, and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
I am too, and here's why. And I've gone both ways on this, and since you didn't mention, I actually thought you were going to mention it for a second, but a very contemporary example of the other way around where people were highly dissatisfied with the casting choice.
I think I know what you're going to say.
What do you think it is?
Jack Reacher.
That's the one I was going to say.
He goes from 6'8 to 5'2.
So that was one where I had the advantage of not having read the Jack Reacher books because I could accept Tom Cruise, and I hadn't built up in my mind a man large in stature like that.
Yeah, me too. I'm the same.
But you're right. Jack Reacher was probably the biggest outcry, maybe outside of Sonic, of a character that didn't look like the way people imagined it. But for me, probably the first time I noticed that particular effect was, granted I'm a little bit older than you, but in the mid-90s, John Grisham's books, he wrote about four in a row that were just bestsellers. And this was about the time they decided to adapt them into movies. So I read The Firm after I had seen the trailer for The Firm. So okay. I pictured Tom Cruise as the main character in The Firm. Mitch McDear, I believe, is his name. Okay. I did not picture Wilford Brimley or Gene Hackman. I mean, that as I read the character descriptions. But then I had heard that they had cast Julia Roberts for the Pelican Brief. And so I actually kind of liked that because the first time when I read through and I had a different idea and then I saw the movie and they didn't look the way they were described, it was actually easier for me to just accept that, okay, it's going to be Julia Roberts, so I might as well just start picturing her now and I'll ignore whatever the descriptions in the book say about her. It's Julia Roberts.
Right. No, totally.
And I actually think that makes some enjoyment. As I've read the Harry Potter books to my kids, I like to do voices. And I'm going to do the voices of the actors in the movie.
Yeah.
As I started to read Lord of the Rings to my son, it was one of the few books that we owned that I hadn't read to the other kids. So this is my youngest. He was really excited to be able to have me read him a book that they hadn't heard yet. But then as I started reading the book, I was like, I got to do the voices from the characters in the movie because they're going to be there and he's going to see the movie. I might as well just prep him now. So we started reading Lord of the Rings and I finally thought, you know what? Why don't we just watch the Hobbit movies so he can get a picture of all these characters in his mind? And that's what we did. We watched the extended Hobbit movies. And as of now, we're not very far into the Lord of the Rings story. But then we watched the first part of the extended version of Lord of the Rings that got to the part of the story where we were. And I realized that means we're going to read some of the setup part that has Kate Blanchett narrating the history of the ring and stuff like that.
Right.
We'll probably read that later in the book. I realize that because the book starts with Bilbo's party.
Right. It goes a little bit out of order.
Yeah. But I was okay with that. I actually, there's a part of me that it's blasphemy to the Tolkien fans, but I think I can't imagine I'm going to like the books better than I like the movies because I thought the movies were outstanding.
They're so good. Yeah.
And to me,
that's where I benefited. I read the books first, so I kind of just accepted what the movies did instead of,
And The Hobbit, I haven't read The Hobbit all the way through, but rewatching The Hobbit trilogy together, all in one big long version, I love Azog the Defiler. I know he's not in the book anywhere. He was completely made up for the movie.
No, I know.
But I loved that. I don't. Maybe I'm weird. I can hear right now Tolkien fans cringing listening to me say that and say this. I apologize to you. I got a couple of close friends that are big Tolkien fans that I'm picturing right now. Just they're going to hit me the next time I see them after they listen to this. But that to me is part of the fun. We're going to get adaptations because you're right. Hollywood doesn't want to take big financial chances. I think of Mortal Engines from about a year or so ago. Based on a book, didn't look right, kind of pretty much rejected by everybody. I didn't even know the book, and I still struggled watching it. Mm-hmm. But I think of Ghost in the Shell a couple years ago, Scarlett Johansson. Never saw the original anime, so when I watched the movie, I could just sort of enjoy it for what it was. But for the people who had known and loved the original, they felt really upset.
It's interesting, too, in some cases, adaptations are better enjoyed if you know the book.
Correct, because you'll get things that the Hunger Games, perfect example. I went and saw the first Hunger Games before I had read any of the books. And in fact, I think I've only read the first Hunger Games book. And the only reason I went to the movie was because this was before I started reviewing them regularly. And I didn't even really want to see it, but I had friends that wanted to see it so badly that I wanted to go see it before them just so I could go back later and go, oh, yeah, no, I already saw that. But
no,
it took me.
That trilogy, I had to watch that with my wife because she'd read all the books and she was my like explainer. I'd be like, well, why is that? And she would tell me.
And that to me was the challenge. So I actually enjoyed the first Hunger Games movie. As I watched it, I thought, okay, I can see why people dig this. But for reals, it took me half the movie just to keep track of people's names.
Oh, yeah.
And that's...
For me, another example of knowing the book before seeing the movie that benefited the movie was The Watchmen. Like, I loved the movie The Watchmen, but I also read the book like 10 times before I saw it, so I knew it inside and out. And, yeah, there were some creative changes to the movie overall, but I really thought it was a good adaptation. Where at the same time, people who had not read the book at all, a lot of them walked out of that movie thinking, what did I just watch?
And that's the two-edged sword of being a fan of it is, to me, there's a part of me that wonders why Hollywood works so hard just to do adaptations because, and, you know, especially in the information culture with Twitter and with the ways that you can reach out on social media and kind of get like-minded people to group with you, you can't satisfy them and the casual fan.
Right.
And really, the hardcore fan is a weird dichotomy because they want the studio to cater specifically to you, to them. Mm-hmm. But they also want other people to like it. And people who aren't already familiar with the story, you got to figure out a way to go somewhere in between. So then that leaves the hardest core fans unhappy. But if they only cater to the hardest core fans, then their average viewer is like, I don't even know what the heck's going on. Jupiter Ascending is a great example.
Yeah.
I don't think it was based on anything, but it was so confusing that nobody could enjoy it.
Yeah, no, it's true. I was going to say, there's one movie that came out recently that kind of broke a mold as far as adaptations go in a successful way. And I don't know if you saw it or you're familiar, but I'll say this. I haven't read any of the books, so I don't know how it fares compared to the book. But I read that Dr. Sleep, the director Mike Flanagan, did a really good job of kind of marrying and satisfying both fans of the book The Shining and fans of the movie The Shining in his adaptation of the sequel, Dr. Sleep.
Now, that's interesting because that was one where a movie was very well received and yet hated by the actual writer of the book.
And a lot of Stephen King author fans didn't like the movie, too.
Interesting. You know, because I'm one of the few people that really loved The Dark Tower. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the heck out of that movie. But friends who had read The Dark Tower did not like it.
Yeah. I went and saw that movie with a bunch of guys who had only read the book, and I didn't. And I thought it was fine, but they were like, this was wrong, this was wrong. But what I was going to say with Dr. Sleep was it was just pretty cool how he basically kind of filled in the gaps of the things that people didn't like about the Kubrick film, but he also included the Kubrick film. It's hard to explain, but he did this really kind of fine line, walking on the edge right down the middle of North and South Korea kind of thing, you know?
making both sides kind of think that wasn't bad.
Or that, you know, that was good enough.
Well, and that's going to be the eternal challenge. I mean, just look at The Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah.
You got people who want the story to be, to follow the way that they feel about the story. And if they don't get that, then they get upset. And I don't say that people are wrong. Like, whoever loved The Last Jedi or Rise of Skywalker, whoever hated either one, guess what? You're both right. Because that's how you feel about it. If you didn't like it, that's okay. If you did like it, that's also okay. My biggest challenge is when people who didn't like it try to convince people who did like it why they shouldn't like it.
Yeah,
that to me is crossing the line. And we'll always have that. And as we go in the information age, we're going to start to cannibalize ourselves even more. I think of Ready Player One, for example. That was an interesting one, an interesting case study, because that's one where the movie couldn't be 100% faithful to the book.
Right.
Because of licensing rights.
Yeah.
and at the same time, key parts of the book, Steven Spielberg refused to include because they were his works.
Right.
That, to me, was another fascinating aspect of all of it. But regardless, I do think people should read the books. I would say probably better to watch. My personal gut reaction is watch the movie first, because it's always going to be a condensed version of what you get in the book. I treated the Harry Potter books as if they were DVD extras, you know, deleted scenes, extended scenes, where I was going to get pretty much the same story as I had seen in the movie, only I was going to get more of it. I mean, think about it. Did you ever read novelizations of movies when you grew up? I loved reading the Star Wars novelizations, Back to the Future.
I never did. I remember seeing them, though. I never read them, though.
And to me, it was like The Karate Kid. Gosh, I reread Karate Kid 1 and 2 like 100 times. Now, part of that was because it was easier to reread the book than it was to watch the movie in the early to mid-80s before, you know, VCRs became everywhere. But you could go at your own pace. You could really dig in and imagine. You weren't limited by how quickly the director moved things around. Sometimes you got additional dialogue and thought processes that they had tried. That they had tried to portray on screen, but weren't able to do. I think of an example: the miniseries 11/22/63 that's on Hulu. Based on the Stephen King book about a guy who travels back in time to prevent the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
In the book, it's half the dialogue is the guy's thoughts in his head, but that doesn't work in the series unless you want to do a voiceover, which Hollywood seems to hate. I don't mind the voiceover, but Hollywood seems to hate it. So what they had to do is create a whole other character who could have conversations with the main character so that all that dialogue that was in his head comes out to where we can hear it. For me, I run a weird line between being a purist and being okay with things. Love Spider-Man. I loved how faithful Sam Raimi was, but I also didn't like that it was Mary Jane that got dropped off the George Washington Bridge and not Gwen Stacy in the original Spider-Man. But eventually I just said, okay, and this is what they've done with the Marvel movies. When they were getting into, you know, Age of Ultron, Civil War, part of the reason I really enjoyed the original, you know, comic versions of those was because of the subtleties and the fact that they could, they gave you time to consider what the impact was. And so when they were going to them in the movies, I'm like, crud, they're using up all the good storylines super fast.
Right.
But they did a good job of working it within the story they were telling. And once I said, okay, I'm just going to accept the rules of this universe as they're giving them to me, that this story follows this one. And then I enjoyed the heck out of it. And I can still go back and reread the originals and enjoy what I liked about them.
Agreed.
All right. We didn't even really get into video games all that much, but video game adaptations. To me, books seem to lend themselves to turning into movies because they're stories that you're meant to immerse yourself in. And sometimes you'd like to see visual representations of, you know, how does somebody else visualize that versus how I visualized it? But with video games, we talked about the spotty record of success, and honestly, spotty is being kind.
Yeah, totally it is.
It's really difficult to translate a game's interactive experience into one that you just watch, especially if the original game had an outstanding story built in.
Right. Oh, and it definitely, time that the game came out, it plays a role too. Because, you know, clearly, like a game like Sonic, which is like a platformer puzzle type game, is a lot different than like Tomb Raider, where you have like, it's basically one long interactive movie already.
Right. So you'd think that some movies, for example, you'd think that Indiana Jones would translate well to a video game. And you'd think that Tomb Raider would transfer well to movies.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly true, necessarily. I did like the Alicia Vikander one pretty well.
Yeah, it took three tries to get it kind of right.
The only thing they got right with Angelina Jolie is I'm going to stop there.
Right, the look, yeah.
But I did like the Alicia Vikander one. I thought that was a pretty cool story. And if they made another one, I wouldn't be opposed to seeing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if I'd rush out to see it, but I wouldn't be opposed to seeing it. Why do video games seem to have such trouble? I mean, let's think about this. Assassin's Creed, we've got Warcraft. I actually liked the Warcraft movie, never really played the game, but I enjoyed the movie for what it was. I thought it was a cool kind of universe that I would love to see a sequel to.
It looked really good, that's for sure. I think one of the big problems with the video games is, especially with, if you look at a character like, let's just use Mario, for example, for this one. He's so iconic, and there's really, in the days when that movie came out, there was really not much to the story. It was just get through the level and save the princess, basically.
Right.
And when that movie came out, I think they just tried to do too much, to go too big.
Wasn't Dennis Hopper in that, too?
Dennis Hopper. Yeah, Dennis Hopper.
John Leguizamo was Mario. No, was he Luigi?
John Leguizamo.
No, no, Bob Hoskins was Mario. John Leguizamo was Luigi. And so we had the guy from Who Framed Roger Rabbit was Mario.
Well, and at the time when that came out, I think that was one of the first video game movies ever made. So Nintendo was just kind of like, sure, go make a movie. They didn't really care. They had no, like, they didn't have any input or, you know, much. They didn't have much say of what they wanted or what was demanded. So that's, I think,
and
that's
then they got exactly what they demanded.
Yeah, exactly. That's where that movie went wrong. Where nowadays, you even have some game developers who have their own studios, like Ubisoft, for example, with Assassin's Creed. So they had a lot of say in what their movie was going to be. I personally didn't like the movie, but I love the games. And I think the place where those movies kind of failed is the Assassin's Creed games, you're pouring hours and hours and hours into these things. So you kind of know these characters almost too well. So when that, again, is condensed down to like a two-hour snippet, it really feels empty. Like, you really don't feel like you're getting what you were familiar with the video game.
Now, I saw Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. I thought that did a pretty good job of taking the story of the long version of The Sands of Time and turning it into a two-hour movie. So maybe it's the property they're starting with. Like, for example, I'm thinking Red Dead Redemption. We're going to get a movie about that, right? Someday? Soon? Later?
Maybe. Yeah, I mean,
it's so popular, maybe. And it's so immersive, and it's, you know, it feels like something that people would want to see a movie of. I don't know.
But at the same time, you wonder, video games are so immersive now, why would anyone want to go to a movie if they can already just immerse themselves in it? Do you know what
I
mean?
No, that's a very good question. That's a very good question.
It's like, why do I want to go pay to watch some guys pretend to be this game when I can just be in this game and do whatever I want, when I want, and make things happen how I want them to happen, you know?
That seems like a pretty good description of today's generations. I'll give you that.
Yeah, totally.
So video games, not a great track record, but we still got other video game adaptations to come. Ironically, the best movie about a video game was an original, Wreck-It Ralph, although it stole some different properties from different video games. I loved Wreck-It Ralph. Wreck-It Ralph kind of got how to do a video game adaptation. Make a different story where the characters don't do what they normally do, but just use them. That way you get the nostalgia factor of, oh, look, Zangief. Oh, look, it's, a knockoff of Mario, because obviously Nintendo wouldn't license this.
It was like the Who Framed Roger Rabbit of video games.
That's a great way to look at it. So video games, still a challenge. Books, always going to be there, and we're going to continue to get these properties because this is what Hollywood does. Christian Odland, Geek Tyrant writer and One Minute Critic on Instagram and YouTube. Thank you so much for joining me again. What can we look forward to from Geek Tyrant and from your One Minute Critic coming up?
I'm actually, speaking of adaptations, I'm delving deep into the James Bond saga. I've started binging all the James Bond movies, and you know, some eras are better than others.
Yes.
But on my channel, I'm going to be doing a little series where I'm going to, you know, rank the Sean Connery era movies, then I'm going to rank the Roger Moore era movies, maybe rank my favorite henchmen.
I like it.
And then do one big overarching ranking of all the James Bond movies. So that'll be coming up until we get No Time to Die in April. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, that's great. Well, then we'll make sure we have you on for the podcast where we talk about James Bond, because I've been prepping up for this as well. I made the claim on this podcast a couple of years ago that Mission Impossible had surpassed James Bond as far as spy, great spy action movies. And boy, rewatching all the Craig movies in a row, I've had to start to reconsider that thought process. So it'll be interesting.
Sure.
I'm sure we will debate that again as we get closer to No Time to Die. Well, thank you so much, Christian. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and I look forward to having you back on again soon, at the latest, when we talk James Bond in the future. Thank you so much for listening to Fan Effect. We'd like you to become a subscriber. If this is your first time on the podcast and you followed it from a social media link, search us out on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or on Google Play Music. That's Fan Effect, EFFECT. Become a subscriber and join us at our next one. Remember, we love this stuff just as much as you do.